Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cuppins, and Kathleen unfortunately cannot be with us today. Today we have a treat for you because we have a returning guest, and actually Andy Collins was one of the very first guests ever to be on this show back in the early days of January 2010. But since then, Andy has been doing an awful lot of things, and he has just finished a new book called Light Quest, and it is about UFOs, but not the UFOs as you know them. Andy, welcome to the show again.
Hello, Philip. How are you? You good?
I'm absolutely brilliant, thank you. You have been into UFO research for several years. In fact, because you started out very young, I can actually say decades, right?
Well, I mean, you know, although I don't like to admit it, I've actually been researching, investigating UFO for 35 years or more, actually. It's probably actually more, but 35 years sounds good, actually.
And you started when you were seven.
Sort of. We won't go too much into past lives or whatever, but I mean, what are UFOs? I mean, they started in 1947, you know, with the famous Kenneth Arnold sighting over Washington State, Mount Rainier, at the Cascade Mountains, with nine gleaming discs or crescent-shaped objects being seen by a pilot named Kenneth Arnold. And this ignited the world with the interest that, you know, something up there in our skies is unidentified. Initially, they were called flying saucers, seemingly a mistake based on the fact that Kenneth Arnold said that they seemed to be skipping through the sky like a saucer. And this was misinterpreted to the degree that people assumed that he was talking about two plates stuck together, like flying saucers going through the air. But that wasn't quite the case. But the thing is that very shortly after this, just a matter of a few days, there was the Roswell incident, you know, the alleged crash of something out near Corona in New Mexico. And this suggested that the US Air Force had actually retrieved something from a ranch locally, and that they were investigating. They were sending it to Wright base in Ohio for further investigation. And of course, this was a headline that went out throughout the world. And then the following day, there was a very embarrassed follow-up news story that said, actually, we've made a mistake. And what was found was in fact a weather balloon. And of course, everybody knows this story, and everybody knows also that there was something more going on, and that in many ways this created the first conspiracy relating to the UFO. In fact, one of the first conspiracies relating to the American government. And to be honest, from this point onwards, I think that the UFO phenomena took a completely different course to what it might have done had this incident occurred, no matter what it was or what it wasn't, you know. And all I can say is that from that point onwards to the present day, you know, we've been told, we've been conditioned in many ways through books, through films, television, media presentations, whatever, that UFOs are the product of space hardware coming from worlds afar, and that inside them are aliens, you know, obviously modernly depicted as greys, and that there is some kind of agenda. They're here for a reason. Now, I will challenge this for the simple reason that in 35 years of UFO research, I found absolutely nothing that would convince me that these things were space hardware. Not one piece of evidence, nothing at all. And that's not putting down the phenomena itself. The phenomena is incredible, you know, what people see, what people experience, missing time episodes, you know, abduction experiences, all the rest of it. But I think that something else is going on, and what LightQuest is to give a brand new perspective, a brand new way of looking at and investigating the UFO phenomena.
So everything what you see about UFO phenomena, you're not debunking or disregarding. You're basically saying that we have been misinterpreting it. And I guess part of that problem is that we have really been, as you say, been looking, I think, it from a very nuts and bolts perspective. And that is something which an awful lot of people have done. And I guess it also is due to the fact that so many of the people who have been looking into this, that's their background. They want to find something nuts and bolts rather than something which is more, I wouldn't necessarily say spiritual, but definitely different. So where has this investigation taken you? What are, in your opinion, UFOs really all about?
Okay, well, the first thing I realised, and this was as far back as the 1970s, was that there seemed to be some kind of relationship between the phenomena that were seen and the individuals that actually see it. It was almost a psychic connection. And this worried me to start with, because I thought, well, if these things are made of nuts and bolts and they're coming from another planet, then how is it that they're in some way related to the witnesses? Because the witnesses themselves seem to have certain key attributes in common with each other, physiological and psychological traits. Now, this is not something that's in the book, by the way, but it was just a factor that was there. Plus, they also seemed to have psychic talents as well. There were people that were more prone to telepathy, astral projection, seeing ghosts, psychometry, touching objects, and, you know, getting some reading relating to the past. And I thought, you know, what is going on here? There's some connection between the phenomena and the people, and this seemed to be something that was that suggested that whatever was inside, if you like, the objects had some kind of link with us, some kind of relationship, some kind of resonance. Now, that didn't, for me, suggest that these things were space hardware. That was the first clue. And then eventually I started to get really disillusioned with the whole idea that alien contact was involved. You know, year after year would go past, nothing would seem to evolve, would seem to change relating to UFO investigation. Nobody found any conclusive pieces of evidence that would suggest that these were nuts and bolts craft. And I got very disillusioned eventually. And this was probably about 1980, 1981. And then a book came along which saved everything as far as my own interest in the subject. And that was Paul Devereaux's book, Earthlights. And what he suggested was that the phenomena, although real, had some relationship to the Earth itself. It wasn't actually coming from a distant part of the universe, that in some way that the manifestations were related in some way to the landscape, to geology, to the environment, to meteorological conditions, to the state and mind of the actual people involved. And this, I thought, this is it. This is getting close to, you know, the way I feel about the subject. But what was more important is that he realized that the actions of these lights, which he called Earth lights, he saw them basically associated with the Earth, manifestations of the Earth, perhaps coming out, you know, at weak points where there are fault lines and tectonic activity going on and rising out of the Earth, appearing for maybe minutes at a time before, you know, vanishing back from wherever they came. But the important thing that he added to it was that these things seem to be sentient. They seem to have a consciousness. They seem to have intelligence and seem to act and respond to people based on this connection between the two. And that was vitally important, I think. That was a very important discovery. But what I think is also important to point out is that he wasn't the first person to suss this. There had been a number of scientific studies, I mean real proper scientific studies, into strange light phenomena, mostly in the United States, that had taken place at places Missouri, around the area of Washington State, various other ones which are all cited by Dr. Greg Little, who's actually done an extensive introduction to LightQuest, saying that these scientific studies not only came to the conclusion that phenomena was real, but that it also seemed to give out some kind of sentience, and also that one of the key factors that seemed to be involved in it was that they seemed to be manifestations of something called plasma. And this is another important stepping stone in our understanding of the new way of looking at the UFO phenomena.
Well, and from what I understand, one of these sightings or one of these case studies is MARFO and the MARFO lights, which for a number of years yes. was deemed to be a big joke in the sense that it was clear that something was happening there, but the official government response was that it was swamp gas. And so this caused a reaction from UFO researchers, basically showing that the American government's stance on so much of the UFO phenomenon was just to debunk it. But I remember reading it in Paul Devereaux's work that actually what the witnesses were describing in MARFA was very much that indeed what they were interacting with had an intelligence yet wasn't what I would call a physical body or something coming close to a physical body, something which you would expect an ordinary ET to have.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, you know, talking about Martha in Texas, it's such a contrast between Martha in Texas and Roswell, New Mexico. If you go into the stores in Roswell, they're full of complete tack. You know, the tacky, you know, plastic, you know, everything from tea towels to, you know, to posters to everything. Little plastic models of crashes and things like this that, to be honest, are awful. And I think after 65 years of the UFO, if it's come down to this, I think it's very sad. If you go to Martha, the people there do not automatically see the phenomena that's seen. And let's point out, it's very, very similar you know, to what you would call the standard UFO. They do not automatically see it in terms of alien hardware. It's just strange lights. I mean, yes, people might see it as alien in nature, but it's much more sort of nebulous phenomena. You know, strange lights that come together, sometimes cluster to form constructs. Sometimes they burst to form, you know, much smaller objects that go off on their own, seemingly with some kind of intelligence, go out and then come back together. You know, I'm in LightQuest, what I do is I bring together a number of cases from Martha that show that we're not just dealing with lights bobbing up and down here. We're actually talking about close encounters as well. You know, close encounters where all of the people concerned came to the conclusion that these objects were intelligent. They were an intelligence in their own right. And I also cite various other UFO hotspots in the United States and in the UK, where very similar things have been assessed relating to what's seen. I mean, we're talking about places as familiar as Avebury, Alton Barnes, Warminster, Rendlesham in Suffolk, the Peak District, and various other places where, you know, over a prolonged period of time, we're not just talking about, you know, the flying saucer era from 1947, but perhaps over hundreds of years, strange phenomena, strange lights, light constructs have been seen and have been obviously interpreted in different ways. And that those who go to these places and interact with them come away saying that what they experience, what they see, seems to have this intelligent nature. And in many cases, when people come away and say, oh, you know, what I saw was a nuts and bolts spacecraft and what I saw was, you know, corporeal space aliens. When you actually look into it, that's not what they saw at all, or not initially at least. What they actually saw was some kind of light ball or a light cluster or something, which, when they actually got very close to it, seemed to transform, almost as if it was responding to the mind of the people that were actually observing it. And get even closer, not only will it have an effect on the bodies of the people that the witnesses involved, but clearly, obviously, on their vehicles, you know, in the classic car stop way. But get even closer, and suddenly you were looking at everything going wobbly, missing time episodes, you know, resulting in onboard experiences, the classic UFO abduction. But it's this, when they get too close, that I started to become very, very interested in. Because I was probably the investigator of the first ever car stop UFO abduction in Britain, which occurred in Essex, in West Essex, in 1974, and was actually reported 3 years later in 1977, and revolved around a whole family from a place called Averley in Essex, who were just on a 20-minute drive home from the woman of the family's mother. And they observed this blue oval-shaped light that came over the car, which they thought was strange. And they thought, oh, look, is one of those UFOs. But that disappeared. And the next thing they know, they rounded a corner, and in front of them was a bank of green mist or fog or gas, was what they described it, that completely engulfed the car as they drove into it. Bear in mind that as this happened, they felt very strange electrostatic effects, you know, that the hair started standing up in their body, they started feeling nauseous, the car engine stopped, the car radio started smoking, and they couldn't even hear the cars roll, the tires rolling over the road as they ploughed into this. And then the next thing they know, they're further on down the same stretch of road. And when they get home, they find out that 3 hours are missing from their lives. Now, they tried to bury this, you know, themselves for a year or so, but it just kept playing back, and they kept having strange dreams of being in this brightly lit room with these strange entities doing things over them and whatever, you know, some kind of traumatic medical examination. And then eventually when they came to me in 1977, I organized through the magazine Flying Saucer Review, hypnosis and a full abduction scenario was revealed. But what's so interesting about this case is that I've still kept friends with the main gentleman, a guy by the name of John Day, who was, you know, the father of the family of which was himself, his wife, and their three children. And two of the children remained asleep in the back seat as all this took place. The third one had got up and was standing with his hands grabbed hold of the passenger and driver's seat as this strange object had passed overhead. And when they came out of this experience, you know, when they sort of suddenly came to again along the same road, everybody was still in the same position. The two children were still asleep. The other boy, he still had his hands clenched over the passenger and driver's seat. And it was as if the actual 3 hours had gone instantaneously. And this was something that mystified me for a while, until eventually I got onto the idea that maybe, just maybe, they didn't spend 3 hours inside a nuts and bolts spacecraft, but on entering this green bank of mist, luminous green mist, let's point this out, that they were actually removed from the space-time continuum, and somehow this created a warp that meant that they actually lost those 3 hours instantaneously. They didn't actually spend it anywhere, but the time was just lost instantaneously. But that something very real did take place to them outside of normal space-time, which involves some kind of communication with a light intelligence or something that seemed to want to make itself known in terms of this standardized method of communication as alien entities, you know, medically examining somebody and giving them information as well to bring back to, you know, humanity or whatever. And, you know, this got my mind thinking. And I first wrote all about this in a book called The Circle Makers in 1992. But I've developed it across the years in a book called Alien Energy. And then finally now in Light Quest in 2012. And I honestly believe that getting too close to this phenomena, which, remember, is intelligent or seems to show, you know, sentient actions. It seems to possess a consciousness within whatever framework of manifestation it exists within. And that somehow this communion, this connection between you and the phenomena plays out in some kind of what I describe as a bubble universe or a drive-through universe, which is actually outside of normal space-time. And then you're plonked back into our, or regurgitated out, or whatever actually happens. And all that's left in your mind is the harrowing experience itself, and perhaps some kind of flashes, flashbacks, dreams, or whatever that reveal how this communication took place, how this contact actually took place. Now, today, we see this in terms of communication with aliens in space hardware coming from worlds afar. But very similar experiences have been going on for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And in the past, when people came too close to these lights, they would suddenly find themselves entering into fairy realm. They would be communicating with fairies or elves or goblins, whatever it was. Certainly, this is what happened in Europe and other places around the world. Other types of more colloquial forms of experience would take place. Or people would find themselves being taken away to hell to be tortured by demons and devils. Or, and I quote a case in Light Quest where somebody came too close to one of these lights, that suddenly in front of them was Jesus Christ. And the next thing he knew, that this person knew, he was a guy in Wales during the Welsh UFO, sorry, not UFO, Welsh flap of strange lights during the 1900s, early 1900s, was that he was flying with Jesus over the terrestrial paradise. And, you know, as if he was having this experience of bliss and ecstasy, this overwhelming, all-encompassing experience. And then the next thing he knows, he's back and the light is disappearing away. It's almost as if the phenomena somehow enables us to experience this encounter, this communion, in whatever way our brains can accept it. And also, it seems as if the intelligences themselves somehow contribute to this, that they now, today, think that what we actually want is this harrowing alien abduction scenario. I mean, and I believe that for the most part, this is of our making. And that, you know, we should be looking at this phenomena as something that has coexisted with humankind for not just hundreds, but thousands, if not millions of years, certainly as far as its presence here on Earth, and maybe out in the cosmos as a whole. Because, you know, I think that these are forms of primordial intelligences that manifest using the medium of plasma, as opposed to, you know, air or the state which we exist within as carbon-based lives. This is a different type of life form that has coexisted with carbon-based life, you know, all the way. Possibly it could even be older than carbon-based life itself.
And Kathleen recently has been working on finalizing a modern rendition of the Ballad of Tamlin, in which you see these same characteristics, the abduction of somebody to a different realm, the time anomaly. Also, this idea that there are certain places where they, i.e. the fairies in this case, live, and where mankind really goes at their own peril because certain things might happen. Certain times of the year where it is more dangerous or where they are more prone to manifest themselves. And also, clearly, something in that other realm which is intelligent, which is somehow able to interact with us.
Exactly.
Apart from fairies and some other lore, do you think our ancestors understood this? Do you think that they were in communication with these things? Like, if I were to say, okay, the ancient Egyptian gods, are they somehow related to this? Where does your investigation into history take you into trying to identify what I'll call the plasma intelligence?
Well, it's a difficult one. I mean, because we could only see it from stories where there are clearly light manifestations and people have interacted with them in some way. In Egypt, for instance, and obviously that's one of my areas of speciality, I don't find any obvious cases of interacting with lights there, not as far as the ancient Egyptians are concerned. I'm sure it must have happened, but it's not clear exactly what would have taken place. But I can only assume that if people did see these lights, then interacting with them would have brought forward, the gods, goddesses, demons, or devils of the ancient Egyptian mythology, because that is what would have been in the minds of the people concerned, the people involved with this. But of course, a comparison there would obviously be the Israelites, and there are many cases in the Bible, of course, of mysterious lights that are seen as manifestations of Yahweh, the Hebrew God, or of course of his angels, the messengers that would actually, be the intermediaries between Yahweh and the and humankind and mortal kind. And obviously we have the more obvious things like Ezekiel's, vision. If you look at that and try to interpret what was going on there, then it's very possible that what was seen and experienced was some kind of complex plasma construct. I have no doubt about this whatsoever. We can't know exactly what was seen or what was experienced. We can't even say that it was an objective thing as far as a visionary experience. But if it was objective, I think that that's absolutely the best solution. But you don't need to see it as simply some kind of weird light manifestation. It could have been an entity, an intelligence in its own right, one which quite clearly Ezekiel would have interpreted in terms of God, of Yahweh, and that it was a manifestation of the cherubim, the angels, the messengers of God themselves. He may have even seen and experienced the cherubim in relation to it. He may have even seen it in terms of, wheels within wheels, because that was the only way his head at that time could interpret or even understand what was actually going on here. In fact, there's a possibility his brain could have even actually interacted with the phenomena to create it to look like wheels. That is actually quite possible.
So where does this intelligence leave us in the sense of can they appear anywhere? Are there certain geological conditions required to do this? As you say, Paul Devereux and several others have noted that these light phenomena seem to appear a lot with tectonic stress. Is that something which goes throughout the world? Or is it very much like an intelligence in the sense that you and I can go anywhere where we decide to go? Can this intelligence decide to go anywhere they want? What is your conclusions on this, if preliminary, if that's the case?
Well, I think it's a worldwide thing. But I think there is a relationship with geology, with earthquakes, with tectonic stress and things like that. For instance, you know, just prior to a number of major earthquakes, there have been massive rises in UFOs, and not just mysterious lights, but, you know, UFO abductions as well. I mean, this took place, for instance, just before the South East Asian tsunami of a few years ago. You know, you will find, and you can look at this up online. I mean, I've got it in my book, The New Circle Makers. It's mentioned in Light Quest as well, that there was a complete upturn in UFO events just prior to that. In fact, so much so that people actually wondered whether the UFOs either caused it, or they were monitoring it, or they were here to warn us that it was about to happen. I mean, you can find this online just by, you know, putting Asian tsunami UFOs now. I mean, it's quite incredible, and it shows this relationship. And, of course, the tsunami was triggered by a major earthquake in the Indian Ocean. And that earthquake was brought about because of incredible stresses and strains upon the tectonic plates that existed, obviously, beneath the ocean at that place. So, in other words, there was this incredible pressure going on. But then you've got to say, hold on, you know, how does this relate to UFOs? Well, the answer is the fact that, you know, if their primary matter, if you like, of the UFO is plasma. And I mean, what is plasma? People will be saying here, well, you know, what is this plasma you keep talking about? Well, it's actually the fourth state of matter. You know, that the first state of matter is solids. The second state of matter is liquid. The third state of matter is gases. And, you know, the higher vibrational state of matter, the fourth state of matter, which the occultists known as the quintessence, you know, or quicksilver or whatever, was plasma, basically. It's the stuff of the universe. I mean, probably as much as 95% of the universe is made up not of the first three states of matter, but the fourth state, plasma, which in many ways makes it the first state of matter, to be honest. You know, I mean, whole stars are made up of plasma. You know, black holes are surrounded by plasma. That's what they eat. You know, neutron stars are huge plasma balls, basically. The sun is a plasma ball. Most stars are essentially just plasma, basically. And what plasma is, in very simple terms, is light photons being emitted by extremely energetic electrons, which are subatomic particles, which are held together in huge seas within magnetic fields, self-generating magnetic fields, you know, and these magnetic fields hold them together like bubbles, you know, like soap bubbles, if you like. But this is the most simplest form, you know, from a scientific point of view. This would describe, for instance, everything from ball lightning to earthquake lights and things like this. But their bigger brothers are what we call the UFOs. And that's when I think that the intelligence really starts to take a hold. These intelligences, I think, exist on a deeper level of existence, a deeper level of reality. And it was the Canadian-born quantum physicist that first really looked into the relationship between plasma and proto-intelligences that manifest within plasma environments. This was a guy by the name of David Baum, and his stuff is well worth checking out. And he died a few years ago, and he spent most of his time in England, actually, doing his research. And what he has to say about, you know, plasma and the intelligences behind it are very, very important. And there's been a number of scientists, mostly in East Europe, who have been continuing this work recently. And they think that plasma environments is the most obvious place to look within the cosmos and closer to Earth for new forms of intelligence. You know, so when we have the SETI initiatives looking you know, trying to listen in to ET out there, you know, what they are suggesting is that we're actually wasting our time using radio frequencies. What we should be doing is looking for fluctuations in electromagnetic fields and energies within plasma environments in deep space. This is where the true intelligences will be. And I think that these intelligences are able to unfurl to exist within plasma environments that come into being quite naturally in many ways. And to exist within them, it almost becomes like their home, if you like, their temporary home for however long that plasma exists. Now, that could be a few microseconds, you know, it could be a few seconds, it could be a few minutes, it could be a few hours. I mean, there's a UFO hotspot called Hestdalen in Norway where they see these strange lights, these light constructs and more complex structures as well. And sometimes these hang around for hours on end and they act clearly in an intelligent manner. You know, these are the intelligences behind the UFOs. You know, they're not nuts and bolts spacecraft coming from worlds afar. You know, they are alien. They are otherworldly. And I think that they don't just exist here, but they can probably instantaneously be here. And then, to be honest, they can be the other side of the cosmos through processes of quantum weirdness, quantum entanglement. You know, they don't necessarily have to be bound to one place or one location. You know, these things, you know, coexist with us, but also I think that they exist out within the cosmos as well. You know, they are intelligences in their own right. You know, they're almost certainly far more intelligent than us, but they also seem to want to interact with us. They seem to want to create what we call the abduction experience, you know, the missing time experience. They seem to want this one-to-one with us, for which, what reason, I don't know. But I think what's important is that we try and change the way we interact with this phenomena. If we see them as the spacecraft of these hideous aliens, whether they be lizard-headed or alien greys, with some kind of agenda, with their only purpose being to try and control the human race, then this is all we're going to get out of it. And we almost make it a reality, you know, whereas if we see this phenomena, these intelligences, you know, on a different level, we can interact with them and we can basically make up our own type of interaction with them, the way we experience it, whether that be, you know, as aliens or whether it be as fairy folk or whether it be as Jesus or whether it be, you know, as a dead relative or whatever. But this one-to-one with them, this communion with them, I think is extremely important to human evolution for some reason.
Well, absolutely. And a few observations. First of all, recently, I believe it's Science Direct, certain astronomers and other experts in basically the field of astronomy have been looking at certain anomalies to do with things like the sun, and they have begun to posit that maybe these anomalies have to do with the fact that there might actually be some kind of intelligence to the sun, to light, which kind of fits in what you are saying on plasma. But also taking one case, and slightly taking, you know, pushing it further than maybe it should be pushed, but just as an illustration. As you were saying, the Asian tsunami, earthquakes giving rise to flooding and people seeing these lights and interacting with them. In the Bible, there is obviously the story of Noah, a guy who is preparing for the flood because he somehow has been told this is going to happen. And this intelligence, which in the Bible becomes Yahweh, tells him of the upcoming event. Is there anything in the plasma intelligence UFO material which suggests that indeed we are communicating with this intelligence, but that this intelligence is there to help us? Or is this intelligence just there? Is it somehow here? And is very much the contact with this intelligence like you do with your neighbor? It can be friendly, it can be extremely deep, but it can also be just saying hi across the garden fence.
Okay, well, I think it's important to remember that we're not probably dealing with a single intelligence here. I think that, you know, the lights themselves, you know, aren't necessarily members of some huge federation, you know, where they go, where they have a code of conduct or whatever. I think that, you know, you're dealing with different types of intelligence here. What I mean by that is that the way they manifest, the way they interact with you, whether they come across as benevolent or malevolent or whatever, will I think change from one to the other. They're like us. They all have individual personalities, individual, you know, signatures, if you like. I think that's the best way of putting it. So we can't say specifically, you know, individual cases, but I do believe in humanity's interest to try and communicate with these things, and to try and do it as often as possible. And what I mean by that is that I don't mean necessarily that you can go out in your back garden and just, you know, attune and say, right, you know, appear to me now. I don't think it works that way. I think it's important that we are in some ways conditioned to the idea that there are certain places that are more important for this type of communication than others. You know, I call them UFO hotspots in the book, but they go under a number of different names. Obviously, you know, window areas, you know, places of electromagnetic anomaly or whatever. And that these places will be obvious from history and from records from more recent times of strange light phenomena. You know, we're talking about places like, you know, Martha in Texas. We're talking about the area of the Yakima Reservation in Washington State, where the current focus is a place called Mount Adams. Places like Avebury and Alton Barnes, which I don't think anybody can deny that there has not been strange phenomena there over a long period of time. Warminster in the 1960s and 70s was Britain's UFO mecca. A lot of people the whole Warminster phenomenon today, but I can tell you about in LightQuest evidence that these lights have been seen in and around Warminster for hundreds and hundreds of years, and that nothing has changed. You know, what people were seeing in the 60s and 70s, for the most part, is part of phenomena that had been there for, you know, as I say, centuries. You know, places like Rendlesham as well, this is a late addition in many ways to the UFO hotspot list. Based on the events there, which I think every UFO enthusiast will know about, that took place in December 1980, you know, where airmen encountered this incredible light construct in the woods there at night, and they interacted with it, got very close to it. Very strange things happened to them. And I actually believe that this took place. Strange lights were seen in the woods around that time. And if you look into this matter more closely, you'll find at Rendlesham that the forest and the area around there has been producing strange lights there for hundreds of years, and that it may even have influenced the writing of the Beowulf story, because Beowulf story is all based around Rendlesham. And, you know, talks about this monster called Grendel. And Grendel appears, his eyes, strange lights precede him. And if you look into the local folklore in that area, you'll find that this, you know, this manifestation of this Grendel is part of this, like, this sort of demonic beasts that were also known under various other names like Black Shuck and things like this. Whose appearance was heralded by these almost, you know, saucer plate shaped, you know, fiery eyes and all the rest of it that would be seen in woodland. And it's exactly the same stuff. You know, what was seen in Anglo-Saxon times is still around today. And, you know, these UFO hotspots, I mean, places like the Peak District, the Dovedale, for instance, I mean, this is somewhere else where recently people have had some incredible interactions with these, you know, strange lights. Paul Devereux calls them earth lights. You know, you call them whatever you want, basically. And again, you will find that these lights have been manifesting in the same area for hundreds and hundreds of years. In the past, obviously, they were seen as either fairies, you know, the visible sign of fairies, or the lights from phantom coaches that were going through the valleys and things like this. And, you know, these are the places which emotively, I think we have the best chance of making contact. Emotively, and I think that's a really important statement, because I think that the connection between us and the phenomena is based on something called quantum entanglement. You know, particles that are inside our mind have twins elsewhere, and they resonate in similar ways. So in other words, what gives us consciousness, intelligence, thought, some pattern that allows that to happen can also be present within the light phenomena itself. And that, you know, the spark of light, you know, the electro, currents that allow for intelligence within our own brain to exist, consciousness to exist, are probably very similar to the way that intelligence exists within those lights. And that makes communication with them actually quite easy on a quantum entanglement level. But there's a lot to say about belief as well. You know, would we feel more easily, likely to communicate with these things in somewhere like the Dovedale of, you know, in the Peak District, or going down your local Tesco's and trying to communicate with them, you know, in an aisle there? Well, it's, you know, a no-brainer. Of course, there is an emotive connection. That emotive connection only works in certain places, under certain conditions, and probably at certain times of the year, you know, maybe on anniversaries of other events, other UFO events taking place in that locality, you know, or at places that have some prominence, like prehistoric sites, stone circles, you know, hilltops, you know, barrows, things like this. I mean, of the sort of monuments that are frequently, you know, found in the area of Avebury and Alton Barn. You know, these places have been the focus of lots of strange lights, not just in the past, hundreds of years ago, as I show in the book, but more recently, they're still being seen. And they're not just weird lights. Sometimes they get very, very close. And when they get very close, that's when the interaction, you know, produces these extraordinary effects, missing time episodes, senses of contact, weird dreams afterwards, weird changes within the actual people. A lot of people involved in these missing time episodes I show are all strongly artistically minded, and afterwards their minds are put onto almost new courses. It influences everything they write, what they paint, you know, what they produce of music wise or poetry, that it seems to inspire them in incredible ways. I mean, yes, it affects them in other ways as well. Sometimes not always for the better, but they become inspired after these events. And I think that that's key to understanding why this is important to human evolution.
Well, you said that they have been around for hundreds, thousands, maybe millions of years. In that scenario, we obviously have been around as well. We have been looking at the UFO phenomenon since 1947. More recently, in the last few decades, yourself, Paul Devereaux, have been looking at it from a different perspective. Is there anything in human history which suggests that either cultures or people have been interacting with this intelligence the way maybe we should have been interacting, or the way we need to interact with them again?
Yes, I mean, you know, there are a number of different encounters with strange beings in the past. I mean, I cite a few examples from medieval times where, you know, these beings just sort of basically turn up, you know, seem to be associated with light manifestation, and in part, you know, words of wisdom that inspire these people to go on to do greater things. I cannot prove that this did involve plasma intelligences, but it wouldn't surprise me. And also, I think that you've got to remember that when people have these type of experiences, they are really secondary in the sense that, you know, I think that when you do get too close to the phenomena, and I think sometimes, remember, it's not always manifesting. I think some of it may just be, you know, almost like a warped field of energy, which is perhaps even invisible. I think that's important to remember as well. And that when this actually takes place, the way it affects our mind is that it gives us the impression that we are encountering some kind of entity, but an entity which we feel is important to us in some way, whether it be an angel, whether it be a god or a goddess, you know, or an ancestral spirit or something like this, and that this knowledge is imparted in that way. And quite clearly for the people involved, it is a physical thing. But I believe if there is any physicality involved, it's only a very, very temporary thing, and then it almost exists outside of our normal understanding of, you know, tangible reality. You know, but I suppose some of the people listening to this are going to say, yeah, but, you know, there are lots of cases where UFO entities have been physically real, you know, and I'd say, well, actually, that's probably the case. I think that what I'm saying here cannot explain everything. Absolutely not. I mean, I try and cite the fact that at the end that people like John Keel in the 1960s and 1970s investigated what he basically saw as strange creatures, you know, of time and space. And some of these seem to be quite physically real. And I mean, we're talking about everything from Mothman, you know, to strange Bigfoot like characters with glowing red eyes, you know, to all sorts of other weird bug-eyed monsters and entities. I mean, including one which I think was from the year 1955 from Kelly Hopkinsville in Kentucky, which is an extraordinary case of a whole family being tormented for a whole night by these goblin-like entities that first manifested following this weird light that was seen descending just outside of their small ranch house. And then suddenly all these creatures were on the roof, moving around. They were shooting at them. They were rolling away and then just getting up and running off. This was real. This was physically real, you know. So something else is going on here. Just occasionally, whatever's manifesting from these lights becomes tangibly real. It's almost like, you know, it's almost like something enters into matter and takes it over on a temporary basis, like a hand being put inside a leather glove and animating it, that somehow our own matter can be manipulated for a very short period of time, I think, before suddenly this no longer, you know, exists any longer and everything just goes back the way it was beforehand. So, you know, don't let the whole plasma thing say to you, oh, well, this is all just some kind of, you know, nebulous contact with these, you know, intelligences that don't really exist. No, it's more physical than that, I think, as well.
Absolutely. It's, you know, UFO stands for unidentified. And as a result, I don't think there is one approach which will ever encompass everything. We've almost run out of time, Andy, but like all men who are born on January 25th, you are a very busy person and you are working on other things, I'm sure. What are those other things?
Well, at the moment, aside from obviously the promotion of LightQuest, which is sort of released this week, I am working on a book called Finding Eden, which is trying to tackle the whole symbolism, origins and purpose of Göbekli Tepe, which is arguably archaeology's most mysterious enigma at this time, a 12,000-year-old stone temple complex uncovered in southeast Turkey and built by hunter-gatherers at the end of the last ice age. You know, what is this all about? You know, why was it built? Why is it there? Did it have any impact upon the rise of civilization? And I'll look at that. I'll look at all the symbols, all the interpretations. I mean, it's like a puzzle just waiting to be put together. But I think that it's more than that, in that I am sure that what I call the Göbekli builders are remembered by much later generations as human angels, the Anunnaki, the immortals, the people that gave mortal kind the rudiments of civilization. They're the watchers and the Nephilim of the Book of Enoch, and their memory was passed down across many millennia, and eventually is recorded in mythological context within these sacred texts, these mythological works and whatever. And this is essentially an extension of the work that I was doing in 1996 within From the Ashes of Angels, which said almost exactly the same, relating to exactly the same area. I said that something went on here that during the early Neolithic age to generate all of these stories of these, mythical beings giving humanity the rudiments of civilization. And what I didn't know then, of course, obviously, is that Göbekli Tepe was just about being uncovered at that very time. And in fact, knowledge of its existence was really not made known publicly until around the year 2000. That was when the first article appeared in a German magazine on the subject. And I am dead certain that this was the missing link, what I was looking for at the time of writing From the Ashes of Angels. So really, this should be a pretty, good romp as far as I'm concerned in writing this new book, because in many ways it's just vindicating what I wrote back in 1996 within From the Ashes of Angels. It's not. I'm taking it on to an entirely new level. And this is a book which should be coming out next year through Inner Traditions. It's called Finding Eden. So watch out for that.
Well, we'll be definitely watching out for that, but right now we will be watching and specifically reading Light Quest. A link for that, if you want to order it via Amazon, you can find on our website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. You can also listen to this show, as well as some of the previous shows. You can go to iTunes, where you can listen to almost 2 years of our shows as well. You can go on Facebook. We have a Facebook page called facebook.com/spiritrevolution, or just search for Spirit Revolution. And in short, there are so many means through which you can listen to this show again and some of our previous shows. Be our guest and entertain yourself. Hours of interviews with some of the leading lights of the alternative world. Andy, as before and as always, it has been a pleasure having you on your show. We are looking forward to Finding Eden, and we will get you on with finding the Omega conclusion to that book very soon.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks. From Kathleen and I, until next week, the truth against the world.